Podium Enterprises presents Future Matter.
In 1918, Ernst Bloch wrote a book called The Spirit of Utopia. It's a very joyful book on utopia. It's a very mystical book about utopia, and it has a really beautiful and very famous beginning, and it starts like this. This is the beginning of a book that's going to tell us how to access a, let's say, a socialist romantic utopia, and it starts like this. I am, we are, that is enough. Now we have to begin. Life has been put in our hands. Why this title of Betraying Utopia? So the idea is that the gesture of betrayal is one that is not only of subversion of utopia, of what we would call a classic Western understanding of utopia, but also to understand that betrayal is the starting in the middle of things. It is a sort of a subversion or a sort of a revolutionary gesture that is in its heart very kind. It is a technique of kindness. It is it declares that or it doesn't really declare anything, because it's a betrayal is a gesture that has to do with working in the shadows, yeah, working in the details and in the corners, in the recess of the mind and of any intellectual operation. But the idea behind this gesture of betrayal is to say we start in the middle of things. We start with what is here, and there is no blank slate. We have to deal with what is around us. It's a bit what Derek Walcott says when he says language is a battlefield, or the idea behind the work of someone like Edouard Glissant that says that we have to make fire of every wood. We have to deal with what is around us and not try to erase the past. We have to be hospitable to, in a way, to what haunts us, and yet still be revolutionaries. Betrayal is a strategy that is akin to the trap or to the metis, the cunning for the Greeks. Meaning that betrayal is about staying close to your enemy, in this case utopia, and corrupt it from the inside. But betrayal also offers us speed and discretion, meaning that we don't need, it is not about attrition necessarily. Yes, just like a trap, we can of course lay dormant inside the gates of the ideal city, of the utopia, and suddenly we can just snap its neck, snap the neck of the tyrant, or in our case abruptly change the subject as a strategy to open new doors, to make holes, pores in the rational discourse, holes that will allow us to let the more chaotic elements in, the monsters that are refusing to be enclosed entirely in the cage of utopia, really. In a way, they propose a much more joyful utopia, much more fragmented and inserted into life, a more practical understanding of utopia. But we will talk about that. So it is, in a way, in complete opposition with let's say, Western understanding, or maybe French understanding of a revolution, or a Russian understanding of the revolution as a clean-up, yeah, as a purge of the wrong ideas. That is not to say that it is not cruel, that it is not harsh against its enemies, but its technique is to charm, is to pervert, and to corrupt. So the idea behind this betraying utopia is to understand how we are going to bring, we're going to analyze utopia, very likely, of course. So we're going to make a brief we're going to analyze the symptoms of this disease of Western utopia, and see how we can pervert it and bring it to more interesting places. Betraying utopia means that utopia is not a horizon, it is not the heavens, it is something that is happening here and now. We betray utopia in order to make it more practical, and the way to make it more practical is to make it come to us in shreds, in fragments, and in the midst of our life and of the shimmering of the diversity. It is that in order, betraying utopia means not deconstructing it, but betraying utopia means breaking it into pieces in order for us to be able to host it. And that operation is one that comes to me from the work of people like Sadia Hartman with her idea of critical affabulation, which I hope I will talk about, or the work of Glissant, of course. But it is also not just texts and names. It is also this idea of betraying utopia is a way to read the world as a practice of utopia, or to read certain situations or certain rituals and certain performative actions that are made that basically are only in the field of oral transmission and silent practices, and that escape theory. And that is one of the traits of a good betrayer, is that they escape the texts. They are we don't write about them, but they also are not interested in being written about. And so it is also a way to say no in a very kind and gentle way. I think betraying utopia, when people cook together, for instance, or when people experiment with their sexuality, for instance, it is a practical or utopia put into practice. Yeah, so that is sort of what I'm thinking about here, or a certain practice of poetry as a gesture of hospitality in order for us to heal or to understand the complexity of a political or emotional landscape. So that is a very practical understanding of utopia, rather than those cartographies. And it's a very Western understanding of utopia as a transparent and absolute space. So, yeah. This shredded utopia inside that falls inside the world, yeah, and maybe you can feel it in this poem by C.A. Conrad called Unknown Duration of Fear, where he opens basically the gates to our utopian mode of thinking. He says, how we spend our days is, of course, how we spend our lives. No matter how many human beings are born to overflow the land, we are still careful to touch. We are careful with the touching. No matter how many human beings are born to push plants and animals off the planet, we only permit touching strangers in a few locations. Crowded subways, buses, airplanes. You do not touch a stranger at the checkout counter, unless it's an accident, and then you apologize. Sorry, say sorry. You cannot touch a stranger at a restaurant. You are not going to hold the stranger's hand while they cut meat, because you will be called insane and asked to leave. If you refuse to leave, if you refuse to stop holding their hand, the police will be called. But if you know them a little, you can shake their hand, hello, and all is well. If you are close friends, you get a hug. If you are lovers, you can taste and smell each other, and that is a marvelous thing the world awaits. There is no way to prevent the cost of living a day as the loss of that day, closer all the time to no more days. Death pisses me off, and I want strangers to know this about me. There is just not enough time to know us all. My goal is to relax with you, stranger, to not fear grabbing your hand at the doorway and introducing myself. And so the way we're going to do it is first by observing what is the first disease, where does the sickness of utopia come from? And of course, what we're going to do is in the form of a trap, meaning that it's just a parody of the real thing, right? It is not the exact analysis of the origins of utopia, which really does not concern me and also does not interest me, but more this idea of like, okay, how do we build a little parody of utopia in order to pervert it? And this technique of the trap is one that is inspired to me by a certain technique of poetry used as a political practice. You find this, for instance, in the work of Etel Adnan or of Derek Walcott or of someone like Edouard Glissant or Ingeborg Bachmann. Ingeborg Bachmann has written a lot also about this idea of poetry as a practice of utopia, as a realistic practice of utopia, but we will talk about this. But you find it also in the work of someone like Medu or Okorafor or Basma Abdelaziz or someone like Larissa Sansour. It is this idea that we need to have an indirect relationship to utopia, one that imitates it in order to pervert it. But now I will sort of paraphrase the work of this beautiful text by Benedict Singleton called Maximum Jailbreak, where they explain what is behind this idea of the trap. Yeah, this idea that the trap is that in which we read the mind of its author and the model of the victim. It is sort of like a parody of our prey. And if our prey is utopia, the first thing we have to do is construct a little parody of it. And the trap, in a way, mobilizes knowledge or an ensemble of forces into new conjunction, and it coaxes effects from the world by manipulating and identifying its extant tendencies rather than imposing a form or applying force. A process in which an intelligence attempts to make contact with an object, combining connivance and opposition, right? It's a process that orientates action towards the future, but is not concerned with the future as a projection. The idea of the future is more like a tool for perversion. It is a black box that we use in order to attract a thing. You know, it's a following the grain of wood or tracking the melting point of an ore or using a lever to lift a boulder. You know, it's this metis, like the Greeks call it. It's a system of complicity. So betraying utopia is building a system of complicity, navigating in ambiguous and shifting environments, using oblique strategies, and allowing for the weak to prevail. So in a way, it is very revolutionary in that sense. It's very much marked by, let's say, left-wing ideology. What is the basic definition of utopia? The idea of utopia is not only that it is a non-space, you know, or an a-space, but it is also a suspension of reality. And it is a suspension of reality because it is a space without time. It is a space that negates the idea of time. There is no transformation in a utopia. It is a perfect, a fixed, transparent space. And I would like to share with you a few things. The first one is this idea of utopia as a transparent, perfect, ideal space where time has stopped, where everything is perfect, and we have finally found a solution to everything. It's a very anxiogenic space, right? And the reason for that is not just because it basically signals the end of the transformation. If there is no time, then there is no possibility for transformation, of course. That would be the first thing, the reason why it's mostly a very anxiogenic environment. And the second one is, of course, because it is a reduction of reality to the mind of one person. Usually utopia are written by, if not one person, at least a very small group of individuals. But when I'm talking about this, I'm talking, of course, about a very classical definition of utopia, one that really does not take into account any possibility for transformation, does not take into account time. And there are, of course, classical critiques of utopia that would say that what is interesting in a utopia is not what it says, but what it hides. Let's go through that list very briefly of what is this classical critique of utopia. You know? On one hand, it equates utopia with a scholastic understanding of salvation, you know, through purification and a division of humans into body and soul. So the critique of utopia that does this parallel between, in a way, scholastic thinking, or what we would call classical thinking, and utopia is to say that, okay, the soul is what is severed from the whole body, because the body belongs to nature, and nature cannot be controlled, as they say in Greek, physē kryptestai phylein, nature likes to be hidden. Very improper translation, but this idea that it's hidden, and if it's hidden, it's not transparent. If it's not transparent, then it cannot be controlled, it cannot be accounted for, and therefore it cannot be modeled, you know, it cannot be shaped in a way that will fit the criterias in order to enter utopia. You know, the future, you know, the sentence, the future belongs to, etc. And that's a very frightening sentence, usually. Yeah, as if the future belonged to someone. Also, in a way, in this critique, also there's this aspect of, like, just to continue on this idea that utopia rejects, in a way, what is non-negotiable. You know, like death, for instance. Utopias don't like to talk so much about death. Utopia refuses what is necessary. You know, refuses what is not interested in listening to this sort of transcendental transformation. It's afraid of the things that are at the crossroad. You know, what is within, and refuses the idea of being guided by principles. Utopia is a refusal to be in the middle of things, a refusal to be in the conversation. It says, basically, let's not rehash or carry on with our enemy and just start somewhere else, you know. Let's leave everything behind. And it is not only basically the beginning of every colonial dream, but it is also profoundly anhistoric, you know. Even though it is obsessed with lineage and with statues, there's a lot of statues and ideas of like remembering the founders in a utopia. But it is really a rejection of history. It only understands history like a child would understand history. It doesn't understand, you know, historiography, this idea of paying attention to the unheard, or making allies with making alliances with what is not there, you know. This obsession of with transparency is also revealed in this common trait, which is to make lists. You know, there's a lot of catalogues of the human nature in utopia in order to expurge it, you know, from its defaults. So, it's as if they in utopia basically it's like the complete ignorance of hauntology. It's the ignorance that we are haunted, or to say it differently, it's as if they had never heard about the subconscious or this idea of being guided by voices. I mean, in a way they are guided by voices, but it's just one voice. That's the problem. It makes me think of this quote by Kristeva, Julia Kristeva, and she says, I'll say it in French first. Faites confiance au monstre qui, à la traversée des langues et des esprits, à l'abri des écrans télévisés et dans le secret des pages, compose l'utopie d'une intimité polyphonique. Translates a bit something like, have confidence in those monsters who, crossing between languages and minds, sheltered from television screens and inhabiting secret pages, make up the utopia of a polyphonic intimacy. And this is the nightmare of a utopia, is polyphony, you know, and of monstrous intimacy. Yeah. I mean, that is not to say that there isn't histories in utopia. So for instance, if you take any, you know, this classical model of, let's say Hollywood, bullshit, where there's a community, everything is going very well, and then one person is different, and one person breaks the perfect model, and then the whole community is in a sort of like pseudo critique, a pseudo socialist critique of its cruelty, or its the fact that it is unkind, or that it wasn't generous or hospitable enough to otherness. And then at the end, it's always basically a new utopia. So it's basically the promise of a new nightmare to exist, because basically every gate and every community is going to is based on the condition of exclusion, of the possibility to exclude and to clean out. You know, I mean, not that everything he says is very interesting, but Giorgio Agamben talks a lot about it when he has studied this problem of banishment and very well. Or you can find it maybe in the pages of Maurice Blanchot, this idea of the unconditional otherness. But beyond that critique, what we will look at is the two, how to go beyond this idea of utopia as a suspension of time, as a reduction of reality. It is also to look at it as something that can come to us in fragments, that if we betray gently the concept of utopia, and if we start to basically put this concept into the bath of time, into a bath of time, if utopia is a three-dimensional object, basically, like a piece of paper or something, and then you put it inside the bath of time, and it starts to bubble and corrode and corrupt itself, and it starts to create monsters. And we'll talk about this idea of the relationship between chimera, monster, utopia, and this idea of sliming utopia, or which for me is equivalent to this idea of betraying utopia in order to maybe find something interesting, or of course just retrace the steps of the people who found very interesting things around this concept. But first, maybe I would like to talk about the intimate relationship between a classical utopia, this idea of the transparent, perfect space, and it's basically, of course, it's not its ancestry, because that would be a bit ridiculous, but you can see that there's a strong utopist tendency in what we call philosophy, or what we would call Greek philosophy. I'll give you an example of that. In philosophy and in utopia, we have to suspend the flow of history, basically. We have to, the suspension of reality, that is the basically the condition of production, or the condition for us to start writing, starts with this idea of what if, right? That is that suspension of reality, this what if. And that gesture is very common in philosophy. I will give you an example. For instance, in Phaedra, the book on discourse on reality, Phaedra just came back from a meeting at his friend's house, Epicrates, and he heard Lysias talk. And Phaedra meets Socrates and tells him, Socrates, look, I've just listened to a very interesting conversation on discourse and reality, which is a interesting for us, of course, when we talk about utopia. And he says, let's talk about it. I want to talk with you about it. And Socrates says, okay, wait, but if we start this conversation, we should have it outside of the city. So there's this first big metaphor that if we want to have a serious conversation about discourse and reality, we should leave Athens. And in that figure, what is Athens? I mean, Athens is a double bind, right? In the first, it is an ideal space. It is the Republic. That would be the Platonic understanding of Athens. It is transparent. But in the eyes of Socrates, specifically when we come to this discourse, I think that it is this place that is in movement. It is the space of the doxa, of the opinion. It is a place of exchange, right? It is a place of transformation in that sense. And in a way, the articulation or the desolidarization of the body and the soul, for instance, is in a way a symptom of that separation of where do we think, in which place do we think, and what is this quality of quietness that is required in order to think. And so we can see that basically this is the the ground rules of Western philosophy, to go to a quieter place in order to be able to think. And of course, there's an ambivalence there, because in a way, separating ourselves in order to be able to think sounds very innocent as a necessity, because of course, articulations require concentration, and the sharing of the fragility of knowledge, or its the amount of care that it requires in order to exist. It's a fragile animal. It is a delicate animal, in a way. This feeling of protection is not just of protection, of course, it is also to preserve it from the brutality of men, from the brutality of the brutality of the sophists, or the brutality of rhetoric and of the layman, basically. So that would be one way to look at it. But another way to look at it is that basically this is the root of this is the moment where things start to go wrong. Because the moment where we walk away from the city to go to this idyllic place under the Gatilia tree next to the river of Ilissos, and sit on this very quiet prairie in order to exchange delicate ideas. It is also the moment where it is basically like a metatopic or a metaphor for the disarticulation in a way of the body and the soul, the body being what is unstable, what is chaotic, etc., etc. We all know this story. And the soul as being something that is, in a way, eternal, that is stable, that guarantees that the truth will always be the truth and that beauty will always be there. And this idea that, like, the idea or the truth needs to be immortal in order to be the truth. It needs to be stable in order to come back to us in the same way. And there's really this idea that basically it is a promise of a future that we can talk to future generations or that we can talk to our peers about the same thing if we define the terms, if we stabilize them. Well, I'm not going to rewrite the history of philosophy right now, but in a way, utopia is a symptom of this desire to acquire a certain kind of stability and a certain kind of to be bathed in the crystalline waters of the truth, something that a guarantee, yes, the truth as a guarantee. This is something that is very classical to Plato, of course, this idea of that the philosopher is the one that guarantees that the truth is what it says and that it is not just a product of sophistic, for instance. There is no trick there. So this feeling of transparency that is equated with this idea of the immortality, the fact that it is very stable, that it will always come back. Well, I've been repeating myself, so this is where utopia comes from. This is where Western utopia comes from. It is a place that is removed and that basically imitates in a very let's say kitsch way the Platonician model of the city, and it's basically just a repeat of that model. The problem is that, of course, because it does not deal with abstractions and with concepts, but a sort of, like, I would say, a reduction of the world, of the real world, into some ideas. I would like to say this. We do not know of any philosopher that was a good king. So this idea of the philosopher king that comes from Plato has never really brought us anything else than catastrophes. And this classical model of utopia basically is a reduction of society to a simplified, almost obscene model. It's like little puppets. And this reaction of disgust or this reaction of being the anxiogenic nature of utopia is well documented in the history. You can look at the work, for instance, of maybe Adorno on the subject. Is this idea of being anxious when we hear those stories of those basically little boys that are playing "If I Were King," and the cruelty that ensues from these models that are basically, in a way, models of exclusion. You know, that would be the classical critique of utopia, that they are models of exclusion. Of course, if you're interested in that, I think of this critique of the isolationist tendencies or exclusionist tendencies of utopia, there's of course the beautiful work of Frantz Fanon on the subject. What shall we do? Что делать? Что делать? And Fanon answers, like, what are we going to do? Now, us as revolutionary, what are we supposed to do? And Fanon says that we have to observe first there are four observations. This is the starting point. And the four observations are the fact that, this is from Francis, but the fact that the bind between living beings cannot be reduced. That is the first observation, that living beings are entangled with each other, one. The two is the fact that we cannot separate humans from other living beings. There is no possible separation of that. That is two. The third one is the vulnerability of humans, the fact that they are fragile. and that especially the ones that are the most fragile are the victims of war, that we have to take care of the trauma of war, and we have to look at war as a disease. Yeah, this is the disease, the mother of all disease. It's the Pazuzu, the goddess of pestilence. Yeah, autumn. So that is the third point. And the fourth point is, the fourth observation is that the care and the time, like the attention it takes to inscribe the living in duration, to basically to remember, like the skills, the imagination that we need to conjure in order to give memory, to inscribe the living, that is Fanon's word, inscrire le vivant, to inscribe the living in time. Meaning, we need to be playful and irreverent with time. We need to betray it in order to mark history and be able to share it. Yeah, to stay collectively together, that there is a solidarity between the living and what is dead. And what is dead is not dead as in it doesn't exist anymore, but it is what is haunting us actively. Yeah, that which roams unseen upon the land is what is moving us, what is silently moving us. Yeah, that is the definition of haunting there. It is a line of thought that resonates from the words of Levinas and of Robert Antelme around the horrors of the concentration camps, all the way to the famous words from Jean-Luc Nancy in La Communauté Affrontée. Sorry, I don't know the title in English. The Confronted Community, maybe. Where he says, méfiez-vous de toute assumption de la communauté. Beware of all the assumptions in a community, right? This is where this critique of utopia, of like, tell me what utopia you have and I will show you what kind of monster you are hiding. Or in the work of Pierre Klossowski called The Living Currency, where Klossowski explains that every utopia is basically the desire, we want to be paid in objects of sensation, we want to be paid in living beings, right? And this is something that also this critique of utopia is perfectly well described in the movie of Pasolini, The 120 Days of Sodoma, the book from Marquis de Sade. A beautiful book to understand this alliance of utopia with its hidden desires to control in order to satisfy one's the totality of one person's pulsions or libidinal work, right? It is in a way the complete opposite of what Moten says, this idea of consent not to be a single being, and Sad is in a way aligned with that critique by saying that the political subconscious of a utopia is to be a single being and to control all the other bodies around it, the characters, you know, and the cities in a utopia are paper thin. They're really reduced to they're oriented or they're aspected towards the desire of its author. So it's really this very authoritarian regime, regardless of the good intentions, if I may say so, of their author. Analysis of utopia as something that is a bit suspicious, that is a bit bourgeois, that is a bit useless from a revolutionary perspective, is actually the analysis that Hervé Marcuse had about art, saying that very roughly Art is needs to be separated or suspended from the societal in order to be able to do its job, which is to produce new conditions of imagination, to speculate on what the real can be or how we can access the real. But that actually, in order to be able to do that, it has to append itself to societal mainstream or societal ideologies. So, in a way, what Marcuse is saying is that art is like a soft betrayal, a gentle betrayal, to resume very quickly all this, the fundamental dynamic of utopian politics. Let's say that every utopia is a political model. It's an unrealistic, suspicious perhaps, a political model. And basically it lies in the dialectic between identity and difference, right? So it is like aiming at imagining a system that is radically different from this one, and yet that we can relate to. And so the general problematic, which is the problematic of the chimera, we will come back to that, is this idea that if utopia is really the moment, the place of salvation, where we will finally be not hungry and free, you know, like, let's say, those two conditions, then it might be in a future that is so far away from us that there is actually no way for us to relate to it. And that is a problematic also that we have in science fiction, where if the science fiction is too much fiction, then basically there's no way to relate to it. So you would have, like, let's say, like, highly speculative science fiction that basically is accused of being just like an abstraction that does not relate to how we can represent it. And therefore, if we cannot relate to it, then why are we even reading it? And that since we know that the person who wrote the book is also a human, that we know that in a way they're cheating because they also don't have the organs in order to access that reality that is basically just an abstraction. So that is also how we could, like, the moment of placement or of, like, the limitation of utopia is also this idea that it has to stay always in the realm of an isotopia, meaning that it has to have simt or like little crochet, little hooks, in order for us to be to be able to identify. Yeah, so little holes, like, in the plot, so that we can actually dig in. Yeah. I want to talk about this example of the chimera because it is used as a model for a classical critique of imagination and the limits of imagination, and we will see how this relates to utopia. So basically, a chimera is a creature that is supposed to be completely new, that is supposed to be out of this world or out of our reality. And a classical critique of imagination is to say that even the most alien body, the chimera, is actually only a collage or an assemblage of known parts. So even the most alien body is nothing more than the association of the fur of a bear with the tail of a lion, with the beak of an eagle, etc., etc. So that there is nothing really completely alien about it. It is, in a way, like Grima says, isotopic. Yeah. So in a way, this creature, the chimera, is nothing more than a three-dimensional object, something that is, in a way, paper thin, that doesn't have any thickness to it. On the other hand, you have the monster. The monster is the breaks this classical understanding of imagination as only a game in a known ensemble of elements. The monster is the chimera when it starts to bubble and transform. When the basically a chimera is a space without time, time understood here as an operation of transformation. And the monster is nothing more than this operation of transformation. And basically, a monster is something that is half in reality and half in a virtuality. Monsters are, you never see them completely, right? Like they're under your bed, they attack you from behind, and the most perfect monsters are the ones that we cannot capture with our imagination. One way to understand it is, or for me to understand it, is to understand the monster as something that is an operation of the haunting. Yes, it is how it appears and disappears at the same time. It is the convergence of traumas, for instance, that emerge and then go back into the earth. It is, the monster is something that, like Reza Nagarestani would say, it is something that shapes a landscape. It doesn't roam in the landscape. It is actually the entirety of the landscape itself. And there's this idea, for instance, in Nagarestani of the Pazuzu demon, which is basically only an operation of transformation. So, meaning that the parts, the organs of the monster, are nothing more than a differential between territory and movement. But let me explain it a little bit more. The horror of Pazuzu is usually embodied as a winged bipedal human-like beast with talons instead of feet and a head concretized through an almost fleshless dog or lion skull. So far, just like a chimera. The long reptilian penis of Pazuzu is a later pestilential modification to its body, which strangely has two pairs of wings instead of one, as if two wings are not adequate for its missions. Pazuzu is also visualized with the right hand upward and the left hand downward, heralding the pest cycle of dust, whose axis is a double flight, or a ferocious interdimensional line of flight from the earth to without, and from without to the earth. The tactical line of the xero-informatic abomination and the traffic zone of its bacterial data. Extremely thin legs bearing an unusual skinny torso. Chest bones are clearly visible as if it suffers anorexia or fatigue. A body struck by famine and carrying its ailing flesh with difficulty. Its wasting body narrates the cyclical desert famine of the Middle East, accompanied by vast locust swarms and other pestilential omens. If the body of Belzebub insinuates a legion of flies with their perverse collective enthusiasm to come together over a fresh, deliquescing carrion or a yellowish lump of excrement, Pazuzu's anthropo-insectoid body bears the black humor of all bodies it overruns, strips naked of flesh all the bodies chewed and peeled off by a sky-blackening swarm of locusts, by the hurtling body of Pazuzu, dehydrated and reduced to a twisted specter of bone and wrinkled skin. Make yourself many, like the locust. Make yourself many, like the swarming locusts. A monster is the most successful monsters, for instance, in cinema or in literature, are usually the monsters where you don't see the entirety of their body. You only have hints of them through their effects in the world. And that is the common point between utopia and monsters. This idea that this non-classical utopia is nothing more than an operation of transformation. It is in our midst, and it is not a chimera, right? It is not the assemblage of the existing political possibilities, but it is a true operation of transformation, and its conditions of existence is that it has to, in a way, lay hidden. It has to be a hybrid. It has to defy our capacity to represent it constantly. It has to escape and betray our tools of rationalization and our desire for transparency and for clarity, just like a monster, or at least like the monster of Pazuzu. The qualities and the properties of a monster or of that type of monster are basically the things we should be looking at if we want to understand this other type of utopia that is basically a much more a utopia that is steeped in the real, that comes to us only in fragments rather than as a fully fledged object, right? So we could just read and talk about monsters and we would understand so much more about this kind of utopia.
Enterprises presents Future Matter.
Let's have a look at sliming utopia and its relation to political practice, one that is in complicity with the practice of poetry, and in a way to monsters, monsters understood as masters of obscurity. A slimy utopia, you cannot really make the cartography of it. At its base, it's a political temptation, right, that starts by saying we cannot shut down the labor of our political subconscious. We acknowledge that there is a subconscious, that most of our life is hidden to us, that most of our desires are hidden to ourselves. But hidden doesn't mean inaccessible or forbidden, right? It just means that our desires will host us rather than us hosting them. Sliming utopia offers us basically ways to of not just reading the world, but of being together. And that kind of utopia, just like a monster, does not know what its body can do. Learns how to live with this obfuscation, and not only learns how to live with this masking, this obscurity, but also draws consequences about it, like does something about it, not in terms of like shedding more light on what is obscure, but finds joyful ways to live with this obscurity. I mean, in a way, it is a vast political program, maybe too vast political program, but we can see the people that are doing this already, you know. Primarily, now I'm thinking, I mean, there are so many, but the person I'm thinking about right now is Sadia Hartman. This idea of, you know, critical fabulation as a way to expose the traumas that exist in the cracks of traumas that are too deep to recount through words alone, you know. And so she has this really beautiful understanding of writing with close to the archive, but also against the archive, not just as a detective, but also as a storyteller, you know. And the understanding of storytelling is not a lie that we tell to children, but as a as a receptacle, as a riddle, as a formal game. And then if you play that game, if you sit inside it, then you will discover truth. You will practice your political organs. You know, you will practice your utopian organs. This kind of utopia is not about imagining another world. It is not about rupture. It is about reading. It's about reading the world as something that is porous, that is porous to utopia, that already encloses political practices that are utopist. They're not political practices per se. They are just in ways of living, you know, in a way. That's the thing. There are political practices that are utopist because they are slimed, because they are in a way tentacular. This is not like a gated community, you know. They are a texture of life. It's very naive, but this is how they are. But just like the monster, they are a relational complex, you know. They're not a manifesto. They are, you know, entangled in the living, and just like a monster, they hate light. If you try to expose this sort of slimy utopia, if you try to explain it or to force it into transform it into a positive object of knowledge, at the very best you misunderstand it, but most of the time what happens is you destroy it. You know, it's like trying to reproduce a certain joie de vivre, a good life, by analyzing its characteristics. You know, it always feels ridiculous. Slimy utopia, just like monsters, is fragile. It cannot be reduced to conceptualization. Because it is a body, you know, it's opaque and it's dense. You know, you can think of situations where, you know, you turn to your friend and you say, that is the life. You know, this is how we should be living. And if you start to analyze too many of the reasons why you would say that, then you destroy that moment. You know, this is why it's a very shifty atmosphere, because it's always on the brink of disappearance. But this is something that, of course, we know how to live, and we know also, but I think also that poetry knows how to capture and bring it back to us later, when we are, in a way, out of it. I will share with you a quote from Reza Negrestani in his book Cyclonopedia that maybe explains a bit better what I'm trying to say. It's about hidden writing, and he says this. He says, "Hidden writing is a model of complicity with whole complex. It suggests we read stories through their plot holes. Hidden writing can be described as utilizing every plot hole, all problematics, every suspicious obscurity or repulsive wrongness as a new plot with a tentacled and autonomous mobility. Hidden writing can grasp a political plot hole without reducing it." I'm thinking about Frederick Jameson, for instance, when it comes to the limits of our imagination, the very concrete limits, how it feels. And he says this, he says very famously that it is easier to imagine the end of the world than it is to imagine the end of capitalism. So basically, the challenge here is not the monsters we will build in science fiction, but it is the utopias we will create that go beyond capitalism. That I think it's Mark Fisher who says that if a capitalist realism is a corrosion of social imagination, then our practice of social imagination is very rusty. And that means that the spaces, the first utopias that we will think about, will look very strange to our eyes, right? If we go beyond the classical imagination, the first utopias that are in this monster slimy experience are will look strange to our eyes, since we have to be completely, we're going to be completely alienated in a way from our political organs. But that is also good news, this idea, this feeling of alienation. So if you read Utopia, or if you hear of a political model that you absolutely cannot relate to, that is not because you don't relate to it in terms of ideology, but you have a hard time even imagining it, that is good news, because it means that just like a detective in a crime scene, we know that it is the hint that there is, that here lies a political, collective, social proposal that feels and sounds weird, that, and it is that weirdness, that feeling of strangeness, this is a sure sign that we are going in a way in maybe not the right direction, but in another direction, that we have momentarily stepped out of the quotidian train, or of the at the very least that we have started to flex our rusty political muscles, right? So that we woke up to our capacity to imagine another world collectively. One who looks at utopia as a necessity, like a necessary space in order to be able to survive. That would be, for instance, what you would find in the early days of Afrofuturism with Sun Ra, or in the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish. So the idea there is that utopia is, it is a space, but it is a space in the present in order to practice imagination. It is a place of not just of resistance, but it is a place where we can create safely without being attacked, you know. I mean, it's, you know, Sun Ra, for instance, it's interesting that it's called Afrofuturism, because in a way it is not about the future as in let's start with the reality that we have and construct a future. That would be more the, let's say, what I call like the Apple, you know, Silicon Valley kind of idea of utopia, you know. But Sun Ra's utopia, for instance, which is a collective practice, of course, says something like, for instance, I am not real. I am just like you. You don't exist in this society. If you did, your people would not be seeking equal rights. You are not real. If you were, you would have some status among the nations of the world. So we are both myths. I do not come to you as a reality. I come to you as the myth. Because that is what black people are, myth. I came from a dream that the black man dreamed long ago. I'm actually a presence sent to you by your ancestors. And you can see in there that there is this creation of a space that is basically, in a way, it is not utopia anymore. It is a start of a flirtation with time. So it is in a sort of uchronia, only it is a very real uchronia. It is not an imagined alternative history. It is a history that is unheard and that hides itself under the word of uchronia. But we will talk a bit about the definition of uchronia. There's another example in that line of thought that is basically the idea of a utopia that is commonly conceived as a space that allows us to see utopia as a process of spending time together, right? Of brief enactments of the possibilities of a process that starts now, like in Afrofuturism, but that also starts in the revolutionary poetry, for instance, of Mahmoud Darwish, or like Derek Walcott would say, it is this moment where we acknowledge that language is the battlefield, and language is a gesture, that poetry is a gesture of hospitality inside language, that basically, for Mahmoud Darwish, poetry establishes a metaphorical homeland, and poems are houses in this landscape. Yes, they're giving the exile a collective house. Mahmoud Darwish says, for instance, my poem's land is green. Yeah, meaning that this is where we can all sit and relax together when there is nothing left. So it is a very practical use of utopia, and in this case of utopic poetry, as an active, very real place where we can sit and meet collectively and practice our imagination collectively. So it is not just, and in that sense, like poetry, the poetry of Mahmoud Darwish and the Afrofuturism stemmed from Sun Ra is not just a simple resonance of politics, but it is a place to generate its own strategy from the inside. Yeah, it is the laws of its hospitality, of its political practice, of magic in a way. It is in the great book of revolution that can be read in the entrails of every poem. That can be, it starts politics in a different way. It's a grammar of utopia that is to be deciphered in the construction of a poem or in the construction of a mythopoetic practice of Sun Ra. Or of Black Quantum Futurism, for instance. So it's it is not just a formal approach, you know, but it is also like how reality can be approached. So this idea of starting reality with a poem, starting reality with a myth, saying that this is where the real is, or to say, like Sun Ra says, I am not real, I am just like you. You understand? It's like it's basically a political program that is hidden and is yet revealed in the midst of a political practice. So it's really a secret that is shared collectively in a way. This kind of utopia as a necessary space in order to survive, as a different kind of departure, also proposes a certain kind of history, a history of negative objects, for instance, or a history of a dark historiography, right? That would be the one that Frantz Fanon proposed in a way, or that you can read, for instance, in Achille Mbembe, if you are interested in these kind of things, that also Arlette Farge talks a lot about. It is a sort of historiography, this dark historiography that is anaclastic, meaning that it knows that we cannot have direct access to, let's say, positive objects, to the archives of, for instance, the life of women in the Middle Age. There is, of course, some positive documents, but it's also that it is anaclastic in the sense that we know that there are some operations that can only be explained if they're by putting up the hypothesis of what was there, right? So, for instance, this very famous concept of the witch, for instance, why is it, in my opinion, of course, associated to feminism? Not because of the reality of the practice of magic, but because of magic represented as a poetical practice of politics. Yeah, meaning that a witch is an operation. It is not a person. It is a relationship. It is a texture of relationships, of political practice that are dark, not because they are devilish, but because they are hidden to the authority. They are hidden to the masculine gaze, to the transparency or the will of control by the lords and by the authorities in general. It is mythopoetic in the sense that it is projective and tendential. It is metamorphic because it acknowledges the presence, the pressure basically between body and language, and it is oral because it always holds an open space for the objects that stay in the shadow, the stories that we say in the woods, the moments where we hide the secret practices that are necessary to the mind, etc., etc. I know I haven't explained very well what is this dark historiography, but that would be an entire different talk. It's a fantastic topic. When the madness of the peoples of the world knocks at the door, we go and open. A man has died in Beirut. A woman too. It's their first night of rest in a long time. Oh, how cold is the ground in full summer when it is watered with absence, 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 absence. There have been mountains of corpses and rivers of blood, bags filled with bones, baskets filled with eyes, bowls filled with lymph. There have been meadows covered with human skin under the Arabian moon, millions of dollars of hatred and tons of sorrow. There have been yellow shells over the mourning of disemboweled houses, tons of despair and gigantic rivers filled with our collective tears. Savage is the enemy who settles in their eyes. The Palestinians are dumped in a spacecraft heading for the moon. They sing their own requiem in the launched rocket. The Arab's son is a perennial atom bomb, drinking milk, sadistic, tubercular. With its fingers soon, the sun caresses the Euphrates. It runs and multiplies from the Atlantic to the Gulf to smash a blade of grass. Riders of clouds, sun Syrian worker, proto-Sinaitic. What a purple and violent abyss broke loose on the primordial land of Syria. What an ancestral love out of the infinite and the universe had to reside in your belly. I smothered the sun with an iron bar, disfigured its words, tore its face and mine. Big black holes, the other's deaths in Beirut. The sun is on its way to extinction. Little pieces of death, pieces of Osiris's body, dispersed while great Isis is absent. Great Isis is absent. I am the root that her tomb crushed. My planet-like face is marked by miserable particles of lead. I advance as a white bird over your heads, with the sun in the bay, feet in the sand, wind in my feet. I chose to wander. A yellow sun has risen on the camp. Yellow sun, blue sun, tattoo and craters and wounds. Live lives which go by in elephant lines. O millenniums, O millenniums of marches and water searches, O caravans of hunger and curiosity, O passion for space, and the species' submission to the cardinal virtues of time. The infectious throbbings of America's bliss have flowered the sky with parachutes. How to forget the rockets come to Venus and Mars? Oh, solar crucifixion and powerlessness of the most brilliant of the stars. Between love and the tenuity of seconds, the sun is trapped. the Arabs, astronomers, follow the wrong stars, and when night falls, they say, here is the beginning, the day, drinking milk. With its fingers, soon the sun caresses the Euphrates. In the Arabian boats, there are sharks shaken with laughter. Out, out of time, there is spring's shattered hope. The Arab's sun is a perennial atom bomb, drinking milk, sadistic, tubercular. Where do you want ghosts to reside? In our wakeful hours, there are flowers which produce nightmares.